There's no reason you would ever come to Shibuta, Mississippi. Maybe a wrong turn south out of Meridian would put you here. There's no plaque or memorial to tell you of the bitter American history here along the Chickasaw River. And if you try, you can't even get to the place where it all happened. Some of the locals know about it, but nobody in this town of 430 will give you a tour. Poet Langston Hughes knew about it. "Oh, tragic, bitter river," he wrote, "where the lynched boys hung. The gall of your bitter water coats my tongue. The blood of your bitter water for me gives back no stars. I'm tired of the bitter river, tired of the bars." The bars he refers to are perhaps from the rickety old iron bridge behind a padlocked fence on private property now, a bridge that was once a place for white vigilantes to hang blacks and then dump their bodies into what legend said was a bottomless pit beneath the river. There are 6 documented lynchings that took place here, 2 men and 2 pregnant women in 1918 and 2 teenage boys in 1942, casualties in the war that eventually brought down the white supremacist government in the state of Mississippi.
I was a graduate student at Yale University. I was in the basement looking at microfilm of old newspapers, and there was an account of the 1942 lynchings of 2 adolescent boys, Ernest Green and Charlie Lang. That was actually a story covered in a New York left-leaning daily. It was called PM, and PM covered civil rights and race issues relatively early and honestly for a white publication. And they sent a journalist named Victor Bernstein down there. And one of the things that was in his story was a shot of the bridge.
Everyone involved remains trapped in a history that they often feel more than they know. That's a line from Jason Ward's book, Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence in America's Civil Rights Century. He believes America's history of racial violence is largely history that is felt but not known. It remains coded in anger that rubs out the facts. In the small rural Mississippi town of Shibuta in Clark County, there are 6 documented lynchings. 2 young men and 2 pregnant women in 1918 expunged from the historical record except for the horrible memories that could never be forgotten. And then the 1942 lynching of 2 young boys on the very same hanging bridge over the Chickasaw River. The bridge has no name, but it is a memorial to brutality, to denial, and to the idea that murders like this can just fade away like a slowly rusting bridge. Why is the hanging bridge in Shibuta, Mississippi still standing? For Jason Ward, that was perhaps the biggest mystery of all.
Running across the 1942 story first meant that any honest journalist was going to quickly point out that this had been the site of a quadruple lynching 24 years before, at another time of world war and racial conflict in the United States. And so the first thing that hit me was the longer story of this site about race and civil rights in the 20th century.
How much did people know about those lynchings, particularly the first ones, which are especially gruesome?
One of the big challenges was 1918, because this was an event that was deliberately obscured and explained away by a media that was local, that was interested as much in protecting the racial status quo and taking white authorities' word for what had happened. So this story would have been impossible if Walter White, who had just gone to work for the NAACP less than a year before, was a fair-complexioned, fair-featured African-American, blonde hair, blue eyes. And this was the third time that he infiltrated a Southern community and investigated a lynching posing as a white man. He was able to give us those events. And because people thought he was white, he became very adept at working both sides of the tracks, both sides of town. He could sit down with white NAACP officials, of whom there were many, particularly at the outset, and also sit down with a white private detective that they hired out of Birmingham, who started asking around at their request about the murdered white man whose deaths sparked the arrest of these 4 employees of his, and then their eventual lynching.
And the details that he unearthed were legends, were like known in the fabric of these communities, particularly the African-American community. It was just terrorized. Can you describe the detail that went along with these lynchings?
The framing of the report is very important. This was 5 weeks after Armistice Day, but this was still the World War I era. And so it's framed as an indictment of American hypocrisy and white supremacy. This is what democracy looks like on the ground in Mississippi. So he was responding directly to the president, the first Southern-born president since the Civil War, and the ways in which they were glossing over and ignoring racial abuse. He was also telling a story that for him was primarily about sexual abuse and exploitation. So two of the victims were young black women, both of whom were pregnant. What Walter White was very eager to point out was that when you asked around town, people believed the father to be their white employer. So Walter White was peeling back not just the racial hypocrisy, but the sexual hypocrisy of blaming lynchings primarily on African-American men lusting after white women. He's really flipping that story. And who better to flip that myth than a man who claims his African-American heritage, but who can pass as white?
And the memories of people at the time include the evidence that the babies were alive in the mothers as they were dangling from this bridge. There was no way to eradicate those memories once you saw that. All of that stayed as part of this terror myth that lived on after the lynchings in 1918, right?
Correct. And that's where the third part of the story comes in, and that's that there was a quadruple lynching in 1918. There was a double lynching in 1942, both in the Jim Crow era. And then the question that I asked was, what does a community like this look like? What transpires? What doesn't transpire in the civil rights era? And what I found was that the movement arrives and really develops somewhat late. 1966 is really the climax of that story, but it's a story that involves racial violence, and it's a story that involves the memory of racial violence. So the story of the fetuses wriggling in the bellies is actually a story that a local African-American woman tells a war on poverty organizer who comes to the community to try to set up Head Start programs for black preschoolers. And she's asking why the community seems so hesitant to stick their necks out at all, signing on with a controversial federal program that local whites saw as a way around their control of welfare and education and school funding. So she literally tells this story of, you know, a long time ago, these folks were lynched. They lynched pregnant women, and you could see these babies wriggling in their bellies. She tells that story to a white, civil rights sympathizing, anti-poverty organizer who's asking, why didn't more people show up for this planning meeting? And that's powerful. That's significant.
Do you think that Mississippi was a white supremacist nation that was alive and well in the United States in the 20th century for many, many decades?
I use the term white supremacist regime because white supremacy was a political goal and a political project, and it was the way in which politics was conducted and government was operated. One of the threads that I think ties the whole story together is actually economics. There's real economic anxiety in the World War I era, in the World War II era, and certainly in the 1960s, and it has to do with whites' perceptions that suddenly African Americans have new economic opportunities, they are more mobile, they are more connected because of the growth of the NAACP and the growing reach of the black press. So there's this real sense that in times when there seems to be economic opportunity, that's always connected to political opportunity, and it's always connected to this real fear that society can flip on its head rather quick. And that's a lesson that went all the way back to the Reconstruction era that followed the Civil War.
The bridge itself, how did you feel when you saw it the first time?
There's certainly moments, and I've had several of them in this project, where the history really hits you. You know, saying the names out loud. That's seeing a physical site which has survived and persisted to this day. And then also seeing the echoes of these types of crimes and this culture of racial violence in the present.
Jason Ward, author of Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence in America's Civil Rights Century.